that in addition to the materials that have been worked on by this subcommittee in the past, you also see under the red tabs some materials that have some committee, subcommittee action in the past from subcommittee number three. But inasmuch as this subcommittee will now be working in the area of Articles 1 and 2, we felt that we should transfer these other materials over into your books so that this subcommittee, when we're completed with this area of work, will have complete articles under consideration. And these other materials have been also drafted by Professor Hartwell and drafted will be taken up today. Classes of crimes and some related materials on that, and materials on principles of construction. Now, the article on purposes and principles of construction has been approved by subcommittee number three. A portion of the draft on classes of crimes, that is the section relating to a designation of crimes and felonies, misdemeanors and petty misdemeanors, has been approved.
Now, which is one of the purposes and principles of
Well, it's about, it's the third, or let's see, the fifth red tab.
Yes. This has been approved?
Yes.
Mr. Sheriff, I missed the commission meeting.
Maybe we're next to the
county. Out of the state.
We had a very fine meeting in your absence, Mr. Chandler.
We blew on pretty fast.
No, we had a good setup because one of them had two votes and he kind of wielded his power.
What's this?
I said one of the members had two votes at the commission meeting and he really exercised his power.
Well, but apparently we've been assigned something we were talking about. If we're not going to be able to do any useful work here for the next 15 minutes, I'd like to be cut up.
Well, that's correct. Go ahead, Don. You can tell a lot better than I can what the thinking of the chairman was.
Well, at our last subcommittee, we discussed where we were going to be going with this subcommittee, and we discussed the alternatives. I talked with Senator Uturi at some length about this. He felt that it would be appropriate and was all for our one chair that with the first two articles. I think we all realize
the first two articles, you mean the classification
and
the general punishment range?
The general principles.
The general principles of the code.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he felt that, and he directed me to go ahead and use my own judgment on this and work with the chairman of the subcommittee and setting out to future work and so
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thank you. We had it seems to me that we had discussed either our last subcommittee meeting or the one before that, crimes involving firearms or something like that. I don't want to get into it, but after Don discussed with Senator Uturi and we reviewed it, it seemed to be his thought that it was more important that we button down these first two articles. And this was discussed somewhat, and we decided to go, since the work has already been started, we decided to go this route. These articles do, of course, set the tone for the whole darn code. Might say, Bob, that at the full commission meeting, we did have some difficulty. I think the difficulty was principally because the members of the full commission had not read the drafts and the minutes. And it took the process of some hours for them to evolve their own reasoning to the points that we had. We got through everything except arson. And on the final day, late in the day, we just got hung up on arson and more in the interest of expediency than anything else that we refer it back to this committee. Don's put it on the agenda for today. We thought we'd handle it at the end. And he has, I think, a pretty satisfactory solution of what we should do there. So we thought we'd handle it last. But except for arson and a part of arson, I might say.
Actually, everything just one section of the arson draft that we have.
Everything else is approved just virtually as we did it. So,
I'm tired out by doing the first day and then ran through it.
We did accomplish that. With respect to robbery, we ended up with a separate and a different section on second degree robbery. As far as language is concerned, and we ended up with two separate ways of committing robbery and second degree. The commission decided to take the accomplice factor, which was one of our first degree robbery factors, and moved it into second degree. Which, since we were going to have a 3 degrees of robbery, as it turned out, anyway, we didn't have any circumstances. Robbery is, I think you come up with the term in robbery. And one other thing I might mention that influenced our thinking on this, and that is that Subcommittee 3 has been pretty well occupied with the work of George Plant, and we're at a good point here where we can move into another area and pick up some of the work that Professor Arthur is involved. So these are important areas, and this is our hardest working subcommittee, and you're all geared up. We can really
go to town as our chairman. He's got a lot of spare time.
So he doesn't practice law.
People could give him some more law work to do. Why wouldn't have to be so often?
That's right.
Put a sign in front of the Capitol
building. That's a kind of a sore spot, I believe. Well, let's get started then. Professor Arthur, we're happy to have you here and indebted to you for the contribution you're making. We can't assure you that we're all totally agree with you, all of you, or even part of this, but agree with you part of it. But we're still happy to have you. We're going to let you pick it up and start it out and see where we go.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm not really not so worried about whether you're agreeing or not. My big worry is how far along the line can I understand what I'm talking about? We've got both the law school, we've got a teacher that the students, they like his work ever so well. They say that he can explain anything under the sun, and they say, why does he understand? There's some limitations as to his understanding. And this is my problem, I'm sure. But today I've got a draft that I think is terribly important as far as this penal code is concerned. It has to do with the mental element of crime. And I think that law teachers and lawyers are guilty of, very often, but certainly here, of having some lingo that they throw around pretty handily without always stopping to think what it means or without. And sometimes you keep the same lingo because it's awfully comfortable. Anyway, the lingo that we're talking about has to do with how you describe the blameworthiness in crime. And I think it's moral blameworthiness that we're talking about. Maybe 1,000 years ago, if you did an act and somebody received harm from it, you were guilty of a crime regardless of whether you had any blameworthy mental element or not. But in this society for the last 700 years, basically we've placed on blameworthiness. Things like specific intent, for instance, purpose or intention, and in larceny, you're not guilty of larceny unless you had the specific intent to permanently deprive the other guy of his property. You pick up a hat and it happens that it's his hat, but you mistook it for your own hat, in spite of the fact that you may deprive him. Property, since you didn't have that specific intent, that moral blameworthiness, you're not guilty. And that's a simple one. A tough one is so-called general criminal intent. One of the difficulties with the whole field here is that I'm afraid that that the law teachers have muddied the water by using some terminology that applies historically and in a lot of states that might not apply in a local or particular state. So it sort of gets the thing. Too many lawyers who have gotten this general law school idea, rather than the specifics of whether local. Then there's recklessness, negligence, strict liability, willful, wanton, malicious, malice, knowingly, corruptly. And some of our neighboring states have the term abandoned and malignant heart in murder. Abandoned and malignant heart. Well, that doesn't make much sense, but this is California language, and it's also Victorian language. And we can do better. Big Frank?
Sounds like an editorial writer.
Well, that's the old government way of talking about it.
Yeah. I think we can do better than that. Maybe we won't really be doing better than that, but at least we'll get language that will be more, you know, like we talked today. Now, the Model Penal Code does two things, one of which I hardly subscribe to, the other one frightens me. It simplifies a great deal and uses language that you can use with a jury that you and they will understand. You're talking to people, talk directly to people, and dealing in front of the county. That part is good. The part that frightens me, I'm trying to speak to some humor, is that it makes you analyze each crime as you prepare the draft. And not only each crime, but each element of the crime. To see if you really mean to have a particular mental element applied to that element of the crime. And we've got to go back a little bit and decide what we mean by elements of the crime. Now, if we adopt this draft that I've got here, which is certainly not my work, I think I've changed one word somewhere along the line. If we adopt it, we won't necessarily, by adopting it, change the law in Oregon. In other words, we're simply setting up four different mental elements, and you can plug any crime you want to in at any level on those mental elements. It might seem at first blush that we're changing the law, but it's when you draft the individual crime and say what mental element is required for that crime, and when you assign a punishment to that crime, then this is where you're making decisions as to how tough you're going to be. So we're really not changing the toughness, although in one respect it may seem like we are when we get into recklessness, but we haven't got there yet. Now, without apologizing, it's certainly true that lawyers have an investment in terminology. They're comfortable with the terminology that they understand. It isn't always the terminology that they can make sense to people. I even think maybe the newspaper men have some terminology along the line that's private talk among themselves, for instance. Of course, they talk to people more often than lawyers do. And in their people talking, they do a pretty good job. But I think we as lawyers, we feel real uncomfortable at changing terminology. We've got a pretty good reason to change it, because it takes away some of our investment. This is some of our capital, some of our stock.
Our biggest problem is going to be this outfit named a revision commission. And that's going to cause us more trouble than anything else.
Indeed.
Because
people think we're changing.
Yeah, particularly the lawyers. The constitutional revision commission. Some of the comments and complaints were made weren't true. Didn't exist. We were revisers, and it was pretty terrible. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Certainly the lawyers, and I'm sure some of the others of you will agree that some indictments are drawn with a string about so long of intentionally, maliciously, corruptly, willfully, wantonly, maliciously, and so forth, they do thus and so. If you've got that long a chain in any one indictment of mental elements, somebody who is quite unsure what mental element was really required. And hopefully we could do something so that this wouldn't be a situation. Now, in Oregon, we've got Oregon State Bar manual of jury instructions for criminal cases, for civil cases too, but unless they've stuck some loose leaf sheets in maybe that I haven't caught up to date with, the instructions just don't have very much to say about the mental element in crime. This is one that worries people, that they'd rather sort of skitter away from. I hope I have all the sheets that I should have. Now, when I talk this way, it sounds like I'm being real critical of Oregon law, and I don't mean to be there, because really, Oregon law is much less old-fashioned,
much clearer than the law in a lot of states than what we're talking about, it seems to me. For instance, and the big delaying trouble you have with a teacher is he's allowed to start to teach at a certain moment, because you know as much or more as I do about both of these. But to give you some idea of the kind of problem we're dealing with, murder is a crime that is defined generally in common law and modern common law as requiring malice. This is like your law school teaches this kind of stuff. And what is malice? Well, you'd say that from your commonly conceived past knowledge of the meaning of malice, you'd say that this means you have a grudge against someone. You want to injure him. There's hatred involved. Well, and certainly this must have been true sometime down to the years, 1500 years ago, that you had to have this kind of a mental element to be guilty of murder. But the courts and ultimately the legislatures kept coming up with new situations that disturbed them terribly. And so they would plug in another situation. For instance, if you shoot a person, meaning only to injure them, and having no particular ill will, the hazard of him being killed under these circumstances was said that he was, regardless of if you hated him. If you commit a crime, this is burning a building down, it's blowing a building up, you don't want to hurt anyone. This is malicious. So either that you had no hatred or grudge or ill will against the person in the building. If you assist your wife who's desperately ill to be relieved of her pain by killing her, you may love her more than anything under the sun, and you don't have any hatred or grudge or ill will, but nevertheless, under the development of the law, this is malice. So we've got a whole bunch of stuff that's malice. It doesn't fit the man in the street's idea of what is malice. I think that any present draft ought to speak in terms of what you really mean, rather than in terms of a word that doesn't mean what people generally think. Well, really, Oregon's done pretty well along those lines. We don't have in ORS 163, in the murder provisions, we don't have this kind of a definition of malice. We have a definition in the statutes which says that malice really means hatred, grudge, or ill will. But even so, maybe that's not necessary. Whether we can agree with this particular way to go about it, this monocultural way to go about it or not, I'd like to make a strong argument in favor of adopting the monocultural approach for the reason that New York has, California is about to, Michigan has, and Illinois has. Now, I don't think that any words you say to a jury are absolute gospel, because people are people and they decide cases on the basis of their general moral sense and their general life experience and the seat of their pants. So you could use different definitions of what we're talking about and perhaps arrive at the same result. But it sure would be helpful to have the same general approach in the biggest states in the country, and in our own state, we have tremendous reservoir, as I'm sure Justice Sloan has said this to you at times, tremendous reservoir of court decisions from excellent courts to follow as precedents to help in keeping it kind of uniform. So as a matter of uniformity, I was sure it would be a good idea from the social conditions in Oregon are so different from anywhere else. Shouldn't work for in the morning. Now, having said that, those things like talking as well, let's go back to the things. Now, the one thing that doesn't appear before you in the draft here is often important, and that's the concept of material elements of an offense from our human point of view. And this is what they're talking about. Back in section 1.14 of the Model Penal Code, this was actually one of our early preliminary drafts, they say that an element of an offense means the conduct, such as hitting somebody in the jaw, this is conduct. The attendant circumstances, this would be whether this guy had just tried to beat my head, he had a pipe or not. If he hadn't, trying to beat my head into the pipe, then the conduct is quite different. The attendant circumstances are different. And three, the result of the conduct. I do some kind of act. What kind of harm comes up as a result of this act? Now, you see, the difficulty in the past has been in indictments and in charges in criminal law that you characterize the crime as being a crime which requires specific intent, or a crime which, if you can prove recklessness, this is enough, or if you can prove negligence, this is enough. But you say this as to the whole shebang as a crime. But really, there are crimes that are split up into different pieces. They're split up into the conduct. And that's one thing. I intended to pull the trigger. But what was my intention as far as the attendant circumstances is concerned? Did I intend that I should pull the trigger with a gun directed at the person who was beating my head with a pipe? Or did I intend to pull the trigger at a person that I thought maybe had $100 in his pocket that I wanted to relieve him of? So the attendant my mental attitude toward the attendant circumstances is different from my mental attitude toward just the act itself, the conduct. And thirdly, the result of the conduct. I'm a little hard put to it to come up with an illustration there. They say that, for instance, the rape is not a specific intent crime, but all you have is general criminal intent. Sure, you intended to do the act, but were you reckless as to whether this person was your wife or whether this person was resisting or consenting? So you've really got to explore the languages of it in connection with the conduct, the attendant circumstances, and the result of the conduct. Now, and this is what the Model Penal Code says we've got to do. It says in drafting matter, as well as a judge and a lawyer matter, when you get into trying the case, if we can set up each crime carefully enough so that everybody knows what mental element applied to each element of the crime, we're in business. Now, the Penal Code says that the material elements of an offense, let me read what they say. They limit it so that things like jurisdiction, venue, and this kind of thing is not a material element of the offense. They mean that the heart of the criminal conduct.
Say that again.
Well, Senator, why don't I say it in the terms that they do, because I think it'll be more meaningful than my way of saying it. They say material element of an offense means an element which does not relate exclusively to the statute of limitation, jurisdiction, venue, or to any other matter similarly unconnected with one, the harm or evil incident to conduct sought to be prevented by the law defining the offense, or two, the existence of a justification or excuse for such conduct. In other words, I'm not sure that I'm verbalizing it very well, but the material elements of the offense are those that make up the conduct, the attendant circumstances, and the result of the conduct. Let me quickly go over what we've done. Now, the first thing, among other things, the Penal Code approach, the Model Penal Code approach, the California approach, the New York, Michigan, Illinois approach, says, generally speaking, that you're not liable for crime unless you're blameworthy. Now, make no mistake, you can have criminal offenses where there's nothing blameworthy about it. If you don't beat the parking meter, and so you get a ticket. Generally speaking, the idea of crime, I think all of us agree that if you really weren't blameworthy, maybe society needs a regulation, but if you weren't blameworthy, the penalty should be a monetary. So we start out in drafting the Penal Code with the idea that we're really dealing with serious crimes, with the aggressive physical assault, with larceny, with murder crimes, and that kind of thing. And that most of those other things are going to be left to other parts of the statute problem. But if we start with that kind of a basis, then we say here in Section 1 of this draft that except as provided in Section 5, which we'll get to a little later, a person is not guilty of a crime unless he acts intentionally. That is some purpose, you see. Knowingly, we've got to define knowingly, recklessly or with criminal negligence, as the law may require. That is to say, as each particular definition of a specific crime may require. With respect to the conduct, the result thereof, or the attendant circumstance. So, just as like playing a musical instrument, I'll get an idea to get the scale under the fingers, so we're talking the same language. We're really talking about four mental elements. And we're talking about those mental elements in connection with three mental elements, and I'm using language that's confusing. Let's say three mental states. And we're talking about applying them.
If I said four mental states,
and we're talking about applying them to three material elements of the crime. And the mental states are intentional or purposeful, knowing, number two, recklessly is the third, and criminal negligence is the fourth.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I begin to get worried because here we are. We have got a whole book full of crimes here, and I'm not sure that we've got each one of them involving one or more of these four things we're now deciding to set up as the test of whether a crime has been committed or not.
Well, the same thought runs through my mind, and particularly just last week I sat in on another subcommittee where we were dealing with kidnapping. We had some discussion concerning this, because in the particular crime that we were defining, there was some thought on the subcommittee that we wouldn't put intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or any such thing as that in the definition of the crime, and we rely on the general criminal intent that we find every crime would have to have through the criminal principles. And the thought that bothers me is we're saying intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence as the law may require, which implies that every specific statute that we heretofore have passed and will pass is going to have to embody this language in its own definition. That I don't know whether I'm expressing
you betcha. No, so that there may be no misunderstanding. This is basic to the operation. You betcha. Now this will require some going back and looking over and tidying up. Make no mistake, but I think it can be done, and I think this is the heart of the operation. I think it's got to be done. Now you said, Senator, that a certain crime could be done with the general criminal intent that is required for every crime. What is general criminal intent? I would be delighted to try to say what general criminal intent is, but I think it's the most formless, the most meaningless, the most confusing, the most to be avoided thing under the sun, and that we can get away from it here. We should get away from it.
Well, I understand this section one and your earlier discussion of what section one says is that every individual statute provides that an act was intentional or knowing. You don't have to be intentional and knowing and
reckless. No, that's right.
Their horrors.
What's the left?
One of the four.
Yeah.
If one of the four or any one of the four, we could apply the four or one of them to every crime from rape to reckless use of fire to any use of a credit card or anything else we've got involved in. And why can't we do it in a general statement like this instead of going back into the individual statutes?
Well, this takes care of it as a general statement for certain situations. For instance, if you draw up a statute and you do not say what mental element
is required, what mental state is required for guilt of that crime, then this draft says that a person can be proved guilty of that crime if you prove that he did it recklessly, or intentionally, but not negligent. If he's to be guilty on the basis of negligence, you've got to say so. Now, if he's to be guilty without any blameworthiness at all, for instance, I go into the hospital for a conference with the doctor, and I put a nickel in the parking meter. I get in there and I faint. I'm out for 6 hours, and I've nothing blameworthy about the fact that I didn't put another nickel in the parking meter. If I'm nevertheless to be penalized for this conduct was not blameworthy, then the statute has got to say it.
Now, let me ask you this. Just turning back in our booklet that we have here, we have an authorized use of a vehicle, which we've already passed upon. And we say here, a person commits the crime of an authorized use of a vehicle when takes, operates, exercises control over, rides in, or otherwise uses another's vehicle, boat, or aircraft without consent of the owner. Now, applying the general principle that we have here, where you say you're not guilty unless you act intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence as the law may require, and we don't provide in this statute that he intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or otherwise does this, then applying that to this, this wouldn't state.
This draft would say that the elements of culpability required for guilt of that offense would be that you intentionally used the other guy's car, or that you used it knowing that you were using the other guy. Well, I'm sure that this isn't, that we're not really making much of a change in the law, but we're setting it out in such a way that everybody knows what you're talking about. Wow. But you could do it recklessly, but not negligent. And so we're going to have to wrestle with what are those two things.
Do I understand it correctly that if we adopt this as now drafted, then we have to go back to unauthorized use of a vehicle and in Section A, insert intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or criminal negligence?
No.
Section B,
you don't have to unless you want to. Now, if you don't, then there will be guilt of that crime on proof of either reckless conduct, knowing conduct, or intentional conduct, but not negligent conduct. But if you felt that you wanted to have that crime possible to be committed on the basis of negligence alone, then you
like
have to go back and pay more.
Like certain sections of arson.
Yeah, you'd have to say it. Yeah. Otherwise, it would require recklessness, knowledge, or purpose, intention.
Yeah.
Now, negligent homicide, we need to get to from there, because really, in terms of this draft, the Oregon Supreme Court has construed the present statute as requiring what this draft would call recklessness. With some technical difficulties, we've got to meet head on. So it's a question of understanding and agreeing on some terminology before we get through that situation. And that there's some real depth in that end of it. Yes, sir?
Well, one of the things, if we're simply gone beyond your point there. Now, is it a possibility that a fellow would be not guilty if he didn't recognize his act as a violation of the law?
Oh.
Is there a distinction between knowing that it's a violation of the law and just knowing it's wrong?
You bet there is. Now, on page 2,
no.
Section 3, subsection 3.
I don't get it. Well, if we're going to cover it elsewhere,
fine. It reads this one real quickly. Knowledge of conduct constitutes an offense, or knowledge of the existence, meaning, or application of the statute defining an offense is not an element of an offense unless the statute clearly so provides.
Oh, I see.
In other words, if you're reckless about knowing what the law is, this doesn't help you at all unless the law says so. This will hardly ever say so, although there is one kind of mistake in law that certainly excuses all the time. I entered into a contract with Bob Chandler about a rifle, we'll say. And my understanding of the contract is that the rifle is now mine. So I take it. As a matter of fact, it isn't mine. So there's a mistake of private property law there. But
I could not be convicted of larceny because I didn't intend to steal the other guy's property. I intended to take my own. I was wrong. But since it requires purpose, and I think purpose as to the act, purpose as to the attendant circumstances, and purpose as to the result, I'm not guilty there. So, but this other kind of thing, I just didn't know was against the law. We're all agreed that that's an any defense. That's really what my thought.
I'm still in the dark on one thing. You say that there are four basic elements here. I'll call them elements. I mean,
sure, that's good.
Intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence. And then you say that really what we're talking about is three, and that the fourth doesn't apply right off. And I don't understand why.
Well, this in mind. And I'm making some arguments that I don't actually buy, but I'm trying to explain what the drafters of this business had in mind. I wasn't the guy who drafted it, although I'm certainly in favor. It is their thought that generally negligence as such should not be a basis of criminal liability, that this kind of conduct is not blameworthy. Now, this is purely a question of how you define negligence. And generally speaking, as far as simple negligence is concerned, the Oregon Supreme Court and most courts have thought in terms of simple negligence as inadvertence, and that's just the word, so let's talk about it a bit. I did something that caused somebody some harm, but I wasn't aware that I was doing a thing that would cause somebody harm, and I wasn't aware of the risk of the harm. I didn't advert to it. I didn't turn to it. I wasn't aware of it. I was surprised, shocked, startled, and grieved by the fact that I harmed somebody. But it wasn't in my mind. Now, I was careless, we'll say. This conduct is quite different from being aware that my conduct involves risk to somebody else, but nevertheless engaging in this conduct.
And I'll try a couple of ideas.
Sure.
In other words, then I go out tonight and get smashed and drive down the highway and run into Ed Elder and kill him, and that's intentionally, knowingly, or reckless. But
it's not all those things. It's only one of them.
Yeah, one. Intentionally or knowingly or reckless. Now, I'm not smashed, and I go out and change my tire this afternoon because I got a flat tire and don't tighten up the bolts very well, and then I go by Elder's, he steps off between a couple of cars, and my rear wheel drops off, and I kill him. Then that...
If you have the mental attitude, I don't give a damn whether they're tight or not.
Then that's criminal negligence, but if I thought I'd tighten them...
More than negligence, that's recklessness, because you have the harm in mind, and you do it nevertheless.
Presuming I intend to put the darn things on right, then you're saying that should not be a criminal
offense.
Generally speaking, it should not be a criminal offense, or at least not a criminal offense of a high degree.
He's supposed to get a lawyer then and go on the civil side.
When you go out on the highway, I don't know whether you've ever had an accident. I suppose I've had some minor ones, and you've had some minor ones, but you don't, at present, usually consider, you don't anticipate that your kind of conduct is going to subject you to criminal responsibility, because you go out with the idea in mind of conducting yourself in a careful manner. I think the general public, and I think the Oregon legislature, came to the conclusion that simple negligence should not get one a permanent penitentiary. That it had to be, the statute says gross negligence as far as the nose is concerned. Definitionally, we're going to have some terribly difficult times in arriving at how to say anything. And I wish Mr. Justice O'Connor were here because he's already said it, and Judge Gilbert has said it in several ways, and they know the thing backwards and forwards. And maybe they would agree with us that we need some changes in how we say it, but they're real sharp cookies as to how to say it. I think it would be useful if we go on into the details of the definitions. And don't let me push it that way, but you better stop here.
Well, I'd just like to make one few comments here while we're on this. I don't think we should get too distressed about these drafts that have been passed on before, because as you'll think back on those, I'm sure you remember, we had a lot of discussion about the mens rea of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And in many of those,
I mean, tell me what mens rea
is. In many of those, we use language that we said had not been defined, such as recklessly.
Yeah.
And we were anticipating that they would be defined a certain way, which I'm happy to see is pretty much what we anticipated. And you'll find that although there are drafts there where we may not specifically say the person intentionally does such and such, it is implicit in the definition of the crime, just as many of our crimes on ORS right now do not in so many words say that any person who intentionally, say, intentionally breaks and enters, you won't find the word intentionally in there, or maybe you won't even find the word willfully, but it's implicit in the crime that you're not talking about a negligent kind of conduct, you're talking about a specific intentional act on the part of the defendant.
And this statute will tell you precisely
right.
What, even if it isn't in the statute, you'll know that it's got to be one of three things.
Right.
And it is to have that fourth thing, the statute's got to say so.
This may be a sidetrack, but we'll come to, for instance, game law to say wanton waste of game. Is wanton going to fit into, or do we have to go to that law change?
I feel stupid because I don't know the current state of that law, but if you don't have any mental element set out in the law as you have it now drafted, then the person has got to have done it intentionally or recklessly or knowingly. Negligently, just carelessly, isn't enough.
Are you saying that even though the statute says wanton, waste of game, and we don't define wantonness?
I'm suggesting that we should use the term wanton. Because
I don't think that's in the statute.
If we use wanton, then you've got to define wanton. And I'd like to get away from using wanton.
Well, but our problem is that we're
referred to that way.
We're not going into the game code.
Is that right?
Now.
That's right.
We're not, but we might be passing something here.
Are we going to pass something here that's going to negate substantial portion?
This is one of the problems that you've had earlier in the game is to deciding whether this penal code shall affect sections that are not part of the penal code. And Don, am I right in believing that our present idea is that we're working with a penal code only and
yes,
we're not seeking to change, to upset the apple cart as far as sections which are not part of the penal code?
That's right.
Theoretically, I think we've got a kind of a moral duty eventually to overhaul ORS totally where there are penalties, but in golly almighty, it's a pretty big mountain to show.
Well, that's
certainly what we do will affect what's done at the
penal code. Yeah, that's an example. I may be wrong, but it may not be any such term, but I'm just wondering, if we won't have to be pretty careful about that when there are statutes that we may leave on the books that may have such terms.
Well, we're not intending to affect statutes other than those contained in the penal code.
Then we wouldn't have any effect on it.
You wouldn't have any effect on it. Theoretically, I would hope that this would be a loud, clear message to the legislature so that whenever they adopt a new penal measure or regulatory measure that doesn't fit within the penal code, that they would buy our lingo and our theory and would do it that way. So maybe that sometime the whole thing would be right.
Well, we got the criminal negligence comment now.
Well, let me just ask a couple questions before you move on so we can put this in perspective. Section 1, General Principles of Liability, Culpability, adopts somewhat the format of Section 2.01 of the Model Penal Code, where you start out by saying a person is not guilty of an offense unless. Now, our present Oregon law doesn't provide that, does it? It just simply says that as used in the statutes related to crimes, criminal procedures, the following definitions apply, right?
Right.
Now, the exact language that you have here was drawn by you based on the Model Penal Code, right?
Not precisely, Chairman. It was picked up bag and baggage from California.
That's
California.
They use this exactly like.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. California got it from the Model Penal Code, but revised it as they felt it should be revised. And I went for California rather than the precise language of the Model Penal Code because I thought that the Model Penal Code has never been adopted cold turkey anywhere. And I thought that it would be well to have language that was real, actual statutory language someplace else in a big state. That's my only reason for going in the California direction rather than the precise language of the Model Penal Code. I thought there would be utility.
Benefit of their decision.
Yes, because the decisions of the two courts back and forth would be useful precedents, would be useful arguments, would be useful for uniformity.
All right, well, I can understand that. I frankly think the Model Penal Code sub 1 is a little bit more precise, but to get back to Bob's original question, we're saying here that a person isn't guilty of crime regardless of what the statute says, unless he acts intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, or in certain cases with criminal negligence, right? Alright. But in any offense, whether I'm charged with taking and using, whether I'm charged, well, that's a hybrid offense, but burglary, robbery, rape, larceny, whatever it is, you would envision the judge would instruct on material elements of the crime like he does now, and then pick up from this general culpability statute instructions that a person can't be found guilty of this offense unless you find beyond a reasonable doubt that he has acted intentionally, defined intentionally, or knowingly, defined knowingly, or recklessly, and find that is this correct?
Generally speaking, correct.
What bothers me here about it is that it seems to put on the same basis those three things. One, intentionally, two, knowingly, and three, recklessly.
I'd like to respond to that, if I may.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't understand it. There will be some crimes where there can be guilt only if the person acted intentionally.
Yeah.
There will be other crimes where there could be guilt if he acted knowingly. There will be other crimes where there could be guilt if he acted recklessly. Now, if the crime is one where the prescribed mental element in the definition of the crime is recklessness, then there's a section here that says if the actual proof shows that he acted either knowingly or intentionally, which is more blameworthy and more serious, then in spite of the fact that all that's required is recklessness, then he's guilty because he acted intentionally. If a crime requires that he acted intentionally or knowingly, and the proof shows that, or rather, let's say that the definition requires that he acted knowingly, that if the proof shows that he acted intentionally, well, then he's guilty. As long as any of, this is set out here in this graph, just a little bit further on.
Well, I wonder this, just to get this out on the table, because it's a thought that's running through my mind. If it's going to be incumbent upon us to state the specific element in the crime, like robbery or burglary or whatever, and find it as an intentional taking of the property of another or whatever, then why wouldn't it be less confusing simply in the general articles to define intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and the elements which we are going to insert in the specific statute, simply define as ORS presently does, and not run the risk of confusing the courts. I mean, now maybe we can straighten this out now, and maybe whoever is going to have to apply this is going to be as confused as I am right now.
Well, could I respond
sure,
to that?
Yeah.
This way, several of these things are not really defined at the present time. They're used, but not defined. There's one problem. And secondly, the definitions are not definitions where they exist that are uniform with other states adopting the Model Penal Code approach. And thirdly, they're not very understandable as far as instructing a jury is concerned. I don't know how well I can defend myself here on this. Let's get out to the president. So, but we have presently in the law it's built up from case law rather than statutory law, a certain body of crimes which are known as specific intent crimes. And you try a case, the judge will tell the jury that this is a specific intent crime that's been attempted by guilty unless the state has proved specific intent, and specific intent is less than so. Now, we're not advocating that, are we?
In the first place, this, our present statutes nowhere define specific intent.
No, but the court decision.
Yes, indeed. But we're putting it in the statute in language that is not lawyer's language in one sense, although it's accurate language, and language that can be used to instruct a jury. We're saying that a person acts intentionally or with intent with respect to his conduct or to a result thereof when it is his conscious purpose to engage in the conduct or cause the result. Now, isn't that specific intent? And aren't we saying it loud and clear so that a jury can understand it? And really, do you think with that language that we're changing the law in a harmful way? I don't think that we are. I think that this is specific intent. And I think that knowledge is general criminal intent, you might say, but it makes a quite a lot more sense to phrase it this way, as I believe.
Well, maybe it would be helpful to me then if, as you suggested a few minutes ago, if you go through the subsequent sections and maybe you come back, maybe it would be helpful. I don't want to hurry on if anybody else. I think, without any doubt, when we talk and think about our responsibility for making policy decisions, we're right at the heart and the guts of the criminal code right here. And we have some fairly big policy decisions to make in this area.
Yes. The present statute's now got 7 different kinds of conduct. Willful conduct, negligent conduct, corrupt conduct, malicious conduct, wrongful conduct, wanton conduct, and knowing conduct. And is it your belief that the 3 plus negligent, is it your belief that the 3 that you, intentional, knowing, and reckless will cover all those?
Yes, sir. Distinct.
You don't feel that we're going to have a problem with wanton sometime?
I think if you'll
look at the present Oregon statutes, the criminal statutes, you'll find that some of the statutes use one or more of those terms, and some of them don't use any of those terms.
Right, and sometimes they use willful and wanton, when willful and wanton
often are
diametrically opposed to what we're saying in the same statute. That with willful, the idea would be that this guy meant to do it, and with wanton, he didn't really mean to do it, but...
Willful
and wanton, I think it's something of this kind. If you're talking to a jury, and if you're going to have to explain what each of those things means, and then they're a little bit contradictory, and you have to say, okay, I'll just go out and decide this case on the basis of this business, I think the mild penal court approach allows them to decide the case on the basis that 2 farmers or 2 construction workers or 2 businessmen would agree that this makes sense. There's a communication problem. I may oversell. I get enthusiastic. Please shoot me down when I get...
No, I'm not trying to speak for you, Professor Arkin, yeah. But I want to make sure that the subcommittee understands what your intent here is, Mr. Ackermann. I think what you're saying here, and you don't intend to say any more than the mild penal court.
No, that
these terms are interchangeable, that say intentionally and recklessly are interchangeable. They're not.
No, they're certainly not interchangeable. Some crimes may depend on proof of intention,
right?
And recklessness would not make you guilty of it. But if the crime says that recklessness is enough, then if you are that much more blameworthy that you really meant to do it, you're guilty. And this will come to a little bit, I think. I may get hung up before I get done. But now, intention and specific intent simply aren't presently defined in the statute. As you say, they're defined in some case law. And I have nothing against the courts.
I just finished a brief in a criminal case, and I was in front of a case tried in front of Al Davis. I was going through the transcript, and he took off on the Supreme Court, and I made the stupid comment, "Well, Your Honor, I don't have any more respect for the Supreme Court than you do."
Now you have to appeal.
Right through the transcript.
Can you edit the transcript and say, "I didn't mean the Oregon Supreme Court, but I meant the Supreme Court of Afghanistan"?
Please, no. This refers to the Canadian Supreme Court. I didn't think you were going to lose that one, did you?
No, but he's going with me.
I think that there are situations now, I know that there are situations now, where one can be guilty of a crime, a true crime, as opposed to simple regulation, without having intended that a certain harm should take place, without having intended that he should even do the act, but under circumstances where he knew that because of what he was doing, the harm would take place. Now, this is not specific intent. For specific intent, you've got to intend that the harm take place and that your act be thus and so on. So I think section 2 here, section 2, subsection 1, intentional. Now, the Model Penal Code uses purposely or purposefully, I don't know exactly which word, but the idea of purpose and intention is the same. And the New York, Michigan, and California drafters use intentionally rather than purposely, simply because, as Senator Burns was saying, intention and intentionally have been around a while in the law and are also pretty good communication between people terms. So let's
get on purpose.
Yeah.
Intentionally is a word we have used in our drafts up to now.
Yeah. Right, you know. So it makes some sense to stick with
it. We've omitted purpose. We have not used purposely.
So that'd be harder to sell to the legislature, harder to sell to the judges, harder to sell to the DAs. Generally speaking, it seems to me that intentionally will sell better. So that's the first one. Now, secondly, it may be that knowingly is too fine a distinction, although there are certainly times when knowing will become important. It would become important, for instance, in how you deal with certain narcotics. Did this guy know that this was a narcotic substance or not? I'm not suggesting it's a policy matter how you handle that one. I'm simply saying that this could be important here. But here, a person acts knowingly or with knowledge with respect to his conduct or to attendant circumstances when he is aware of the nature of his conduct or that those circumstances exist. A person acts knowingly or with knowledge with respect to a result of his conduct when he is aware that his conduct is practically certain to cause the result. You don't have to have a conscious purpose in causing the result. But if you know that it's practically certain that it will come about, for instance, I act knowingly with respect to somebody getting killed if I burn a building, an apartment house for instance, or if I blow up the building. I don't really want to kill anybody, but there are a whole bunch of people in there. I didn't intend to kill them, but I acted knowingly because I was aware that my conduct was practically certain to cause the result. And I think it makes some sense. I think it's a useful term, and it covers. And isn't it better than wantonly or willfully? Doesn't it have more precise meaning, I think?
Practically, the word of honor is
no, I don't think so.
You think that practically certain is more precise than likely? That conduct is likely to cause the result?
Well, I think it's different. It's but
different.
It's more precise.
Practically certain is a lot, requires a lot more proof than likely.
To me, it does.
To me.
Now, maybe.
I'm going to say that I that likely to kill somebody in this building, you know, that's But when you say practically certain to kill somebody in this building, well, that's a far finer definition as far as, I'm not sure I want to make it that fine.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty...
Oh, sure. You might prefer to use reckless in regard to crime or attempt.
Yeah.
Sure. And this draft doesn't make that kind of a moral or policy judgment. It simply sets up the framework that you can plug in the judgment to. Now, three, a person acts recklessly or is reckless with respect to attendant circumstances or the result of his conduct when he acts in awareness of a substantial risk that the circumstances exist or that his conduct will cause the result and his disregard is unjustifiable and constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation. Now, gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation is pretty general, pretty vague, and defines itself in terms of itself.
Does that mean gross negligence?
No, I don't really think it does, and here's why this doesn't mean gross negligence. And gentlemen, we're really dealing in terms of what this means, rather than in terms of what the current Oregon statutes and cases mean, and I don't mean to change anything. I mean simply so that we can all understand what we're saying. Look at this a moment. A person acts recklessly or is reckless with respect to attendant circumstances or the result of conduct when he acts in awareness of a substantial risk. He's got to be, for instance, let us assume that it's 1 o'clock Saturday night and I've had a few drinks and I just want to have a little excitement. So I go down Commercial Street in Salem at 90 miles an hour. Somebody might get hurt. I'm aware of the risk. Now, I'm aware of the risk and I disregard this risk and my disregard is unjustifiable. Now, if my wife had just been involved in an accident and was bleeding to death and I were taking her to Salem Memorial Hospital, I would still be aware of the risk and would be disregarding it. But the jury would have the possibility of saying that this disregard was justifiable under those circumstances. Now, as to whether it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation,
again, would be a jury question.
Yeah, it's a jury question. Real good jury argument.
You mentioned we're applying the community ethics, the community standard of judgment to the situation. We're not imposing a standard of judgment on the local community. This is the community's judgment.
To use your own example, referring to the situation being somebody driving down Commercial Street, not the fact that somebody would have had a couple of drinks.
All the attendant circumstances is what you're referring to, isn't it?
Really? Let's see what Bob has it.
Well, then you're going to have to say to the jury that anybody who's, if everybody who's had a few drinks wants to raise a little hell is likely to drive 90 miles an hour down that street, then it's not a crime.
No, I don't think so. Now, in this draft, we've taken care of the possibility with a suggested section that says that if you didn't realize the risk because you were drunk, then you're reckless. Nevertheless, that you don't really have to realize the risk, that you were reckless in taking a sip full in the first place. Now, there's an Oregon Supreme Court decision in 1966 that hasn't yet got into the Supreme Court reports. People versus, or State versus Montee, where Mr. Justice Goodman said this. The obvious purpose of so-and-so is to keep off the highways those drivers whose judgment, vision, reflexes, and ability to see and react have been impaired by drink. A driver so contemptuous of the law as to violate the drunk driving statute demonstrates a reckless disregard for the rights of others, where the state produces evidence of such driving, together with any act of negligence causing death. There is sufficient connection between the drunkenness and the negligence to constitute gross negligence. Now, the difficulty of what I'm saying all along the line here is that I'm using recklessness instead of gross negligence as it's presently used. The thing's the same. But now, and we've got a section here, a suggested section, which the Model Penal Code suggests, and which I didn't include in the main draft here, but which is
page six.
A person acts recklessly or is reckless with respect to attendant circumstances or the result of his conduct, in awareness of a substantial risk
that the circumstances exist, or that his conduct will cause the result, and his disregard is unjustifiable and constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation. A person who creates such a substantial risk, but is unaware thereof, solely by reason of voluntary intoxication, also acts recklessly with respect to it.
That's Michigan.
Well, Michigan has it, the Model Penal Code has it. No, this is a policy decision, and that's why I stuck it the back end. I think I'm a little tempted here to slide by this recklessness business a little too easy, because what I'm...
Oh, I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to come back. If I understand you correctly, in the light of that Supreme Court opinion, you're saying that recklessly would be the same as gross negligence.
Well, the Oregon Supreme Court has said that gross negligence, as we now have it by statute, means recklessness.
Reckless disregard of the rights of others, as stated in the get-go.
Precisely. They have adopted, they have said specifically that you can use the Chapter 30 guest statute definition of negligence, of that degree, of that mental element required under the guest statute, that you can use that in a criminal case. And that's State versus in State versus Hogman, 244 Oregon 219, the Oregon Supreme Court held that gross negligence is the same when applied to civil law as the guest passenger statute. That's when used to define an ingredient of crime. But the guest passenger statute definition of gross negligence may properly be used in instructing the jury in a negligent homicide case. And that in gross negligence, we find not simply an inadvertent breach of duty or imprudent conduct, as in ordinary negligence, but the violation of the duty to others is so flagrant as to evidence an indifference to or reckless disregard of the rights of others. So the court at present is saying that to be guilty of negligent homicide because you're grossly negligent, that you've really got to be reckless. I'm oversimplifying in what I'm saying. Because we've got this problem, and I'm going to get myself in real trouble with the next one here, and I don't mean to... It occurs to me that maybe, as we talk here today, that you may want to do nothing about this draft at all. But take it home and look it over, think it over, and maybe I could suggest a couple of things to read about it. I don't want to be selling it too hard, but I'd like you to consider it. But the recklessness thing where I get myself in real trouble is that the Model Penal Code, California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, idea of recklessness is where one is subjectively aware of the risk, that he realizes that this is a risky deal and he does it anyway. Now, I think that the Oregon Supreme Court, in saying that you've got to be reckless to be guilty of a crime requiring gross negligence, is saying, no, you don't have to realize the risk, but you've got to conduct yourself under circumstances where the normal person would have realized the risk. In other words, the Oregon Supreme Court, I think, is setting up an objective standard, where it's what the jury thinks a guy ought to have done. And I think this thing is saying, as far as the risk is concerned, did he subjectively realize it? And we're going to let the jury decide how big a risk this was. This is where I'm in the greatest trouble, in two ways, in being able to express myself and in whether you're going to want to do it. But again, I think it's perfectly proper to do it. I think it's a question of, we're not making a policy decision here as to what we want to do to punish certain people in certain circumstances. We're simply setting up different gradations, and then you can plug them in wherever you want to plug them in. But now when you get to negligence, the next one down the line here, this is also involves risk and a substantial deviation from proper conduct, but under circumstances where the person is not aware of the risk. A person acts with criminal negligence or is criminally negligent with respect to attendant circumstances or the result of his conduct when he should be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the circumstances exist or that his conduct will cause the result, and his failure to be aware of the risk constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation. Then
You could plug in a crime.
Then your number 3 on page 1 here adopts the model penal code lead of making recklessness a subjective awareness.
Yes.
And rejects the Oregon Supreme Court construction of it as being an objective standard.
Well,
and then you go over and you insert that in 4.
Yeah,
and
precisely.
And make the adherence to the objective standard to lesser degree, presumably.
That's right, sure.
All right, now.
Because I don't know what Jeannie's doing with some reckless crime. She's doing something with some, no.
Jenny Maloney said she was acting recklessly.
No, I'm basically following the pattern of the EM, but using recklessly as a subjective standard, using negligence as a pure objective standard.
And you do have some negligent crimes, I think.
Yes, but there will be one in assault. The criminal negligence will let the handling of deadly weapons. And it will just require, you know, just the first set of acts will be negligent, as defined by the last couple of days. But this will depend on each side of the meeting today, too, because I'll change the draft before it's considered. You changed the culpability on it, which. So, as drafted, I haven't put anything in relating to negligence yet.
That's substantially what's been done here. I can't take credit for it because it's what the model penal code does in California and so on. Now the next section, section 3, says that if the definition of an offense prescribes a culpable mental state but does not specify the conduct, the circumstances, or the result to which it applies, then it applies to each such material element. It applies to the conduct, the circumstances, and the result. Now, if the definition of a crime prescribes criminal negligence as the culpable mental state, it is also established if a person acts intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. When recklessness suffices to establish a culpable mental state, it is also established if a person acts intentionally or knowingly. And when acting knowingly is enough, then if he acts intentionally, of course he's guilty then too. Then this next one is the one that Mr. Elder was referring to. The mere fact that you don't know that the law says you shan't do this thing, this is no defense. And then section 4 says that except as provided in section 5, if the definition of a crime does not expressly prescribe a culpable mental state, a culpable mental state is nonetheless required and is established only if a person acts intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. So if you forget to put in a mental state in a crime, negligently is not enough. You've got to consciously put that into the statute before that's enough for guilt. And in 5, this is the kind of parking meter, oleo marker kind of thing.
Well,
you're saying that you say that a person negligently uses fire or reckless use of fire. He's guilty of a crime.
You can't say negligently.
Got to say it's reckless. Now, if he just does it negligently, and we don't say negligently, then he's not guilty.
Yeah. Let's see if I can say it this way. Assume that you had a simplistic statute that said that a person who shoots another with a firearm is guilty of assault with a firearm, and upon conviction shall be punished by so and so. Now, if that's the statute, then we're saying that if he shoots him recklessly, he's guilty. If he shoots him knowingly, he's guilty. If he shoots him intentionally, he's guilty. But if he did it only carelessly, he's not guilty of that particular crime because Now, if we said if a person who recklessly shoots another is guilty of this crime, if you prove that he did it knowingly, if you prove that he did it intentionally, this is enough to convict him.
Thought is that generally states and revisions and so forth are getting away from the idea of making negligence a crime where the states haven't done it by in revisions while the courts are doing it by decision.
I think so, but I should be very candid and say that again, this is a policy matter. There are some very respectable legal writers who say that if it is if
conduct is negligent in the sense that you weren't aware of what was going on. It was really inadvertent. But how can you reform people? How can you prevent this kind of conduct in the future? Because at the time the person did the thing, he wasn't aware of what he was doing. So the penal law doesn't make any sense. Now, the other argument is, yeah, but if there's a chance of you going to penitentiary because you were careless, you'll start thinking about these things in the future. But at all events, I think, generally speaking, to the extent that we are emotional, and I think I am, if you aren't, we tend to think of sending people to the penitentiary where they have a death as a result of conduct with an automobile, for instance. Not simply because of the harm happened, because people do get killed every day, but because we find the conduct socially extremely unacceptable. And therefore,
especially if the person gets killed.
Yeah, of course, but still, it's a question of.
No, I don't know.
There are so many degrees and shadings of carelessness with an automobile, I suppose. But let me be very frank to say that in the final analysis, no matter what language we use, we're basically leaving it up to the judgment of 12 people sitting there, aren't we?
No, we're not.
Mm-hmm.
Because every 100 arrests, 2 or 3 wind up in front of the 12 people. Actually, in most of these cases, think we're going to create this crime, in most cases are going to be the decision, basic decision is going to be made by the district attorney and a defense lawyer sitting down and talking it over, and the defense lawyer will come to some agreement with his client.
Well, that I agree thoroughly, but I do believe that everywhere in the state or any state, that the prosecutor is going to have some responsiveness to the public ethics in that community.
Yes.
That he isn't going to make these decisions
based on what a jury might do.
These
dealings are going to be based on what a jury probably expected to do. Yeah, expected to do.
Because he won't be around after the next election. Maybe he didn't want to be around, but most of them still do want to be around. They're generally going to be responsible.
I don't think any speech about district attorneys today.
Well, I grant you, it would be lots better if we had better district attorneys, better defense counsel, better judges, better law teachers, better
newspaper. I'll even go so far as to say better newspaper editors.
Dollar.
Well, I just thought I'd mention that with respect to the section 4, the commentary of the Kennedy draft number 4 is interesting, I think. And they state that that paragraph provides, unless the kind of culpability is sufficient to establish a material element of offense has been prescribed by law, it is established if a person acted purposely, knowingly or recklessly with respect thereto. This accepts as the basic norm what usually is regarded as the common law position. More importantly, it represents the most convenient norm for drafting purposes, since when purpose or knowledge is to be required, it is normal to so state, and negligence ought to be viewed as an exceptional basis of liability.
But that's their feeling, yeah, that it should be. Certainly, it seems to me that inadvertent negligence. How do you tell the difference, for instance, between the situation where a guy was careless or negligent and he didn't realize what was happening, a situation where he should have realized, and a situation where he didn't realize? I'm frank to say that we're dealing with a real difficult area that everybody gets upset about. I'm looking for something here, I'm not finding it. Well, let's go ahead to remaining one more section here. Maybe I go through fast because it's the handy way to get away from difficulty with it. Section 5 on page 3 says that the culpable mental state requirements of section 1 and section 5 do not apply if the offense is a violation. This is in anything where you cannot be jailed, you see, where all you can get is a fine.
Is that how violation is going to be defined?
That is how it's defined so far. Now, the commission might change its mind on that eventually, or the legislature might change its mind, but this is how it defined it so far. If there's no possibility of going to jail, then it's a violation, and it doesn't require under this draft, it doesn't apply. a culpable mental state.
If it's punishable, only by fine.
Yeah.
Now, there are some states that apply this to where you can get no more than, say, 15 days jail. But we took this other tack. Or if the law defining the offense clearly indicates a purpose to dispense with any culpable mental state requirement. For instance, assume that now we're going to have a crime of possession of marijuana. You could specifically provide that knowledge of the nature of the substance is not required. And then you could have guilt by possession without more. But if
somebody planted it on you.
And then you've got a real problem now. Fortunately, we don't have to make those decisions right now. But I would say then that possession would not be an act under those circumstances.
You're talking about a new concept here with Section 4?
With Section 4, well, let's see.
The body can be still right.
Well, let me make, I'm a little embarrassed. I'm sure that I'm making law teacher statements all along the line. There was a case back in 1952 or so called Morissette versus the United States, where Morissette was charged with, under a federal theft statute, with having stolen some spent brass shell casings on a bombing range in Michigan. And the statute in that case did not say that he had to intend to steal them. As a matter of fact, he thought they were abandoned. I guess they weren't brass because they were steel. They'd just been lying around rusting out in the woods. He thought they were abandoned, so he stuck them in a truck and jumped them. And the federal district court convicted him in spite of the fact that it was quite obvious that he thought they were abandoned, that he didn't intend to steal anything. And it was reasonable to think that they were abandoned. And the district court said, yes, but this statute doesn't say that you've got to intend to steal them. It says you're guilty just if you take them and go away with them. What if the United States Supreme Court? The United States Supreme Court said this in effect. They said that for any true crime where there's a severe punishment, regardless of whether the statute says that you've got to have a blameworthy mental element, that by golly, you do have to, and that you'll have to construe a statute which doesn't require a blameworthy mental element. You'll have to construe it as requiring one if it's a true crime and if there is a substantial punishment involved. Now that case is good authority as far as the larceny crimes or the theft crimes are concerned. It doesn't cover a whole lot of other crimes because the facts are only larceny facts.
And really what you're saying is the legislature in the future in passing the law will have to deal with this.
Yeah, and shouldn't they? Really?
They should, yeah.
Should they give a blank, kind of a blank check? But are we going to leave judges, prosecutors, lawyers, jurors to guess which mental element the legislature meant was involved with the crime? Let's say it. It's kind of tough at this stage of the game, but we ought to say it.
And if they don't say anything, then one of these three...
One of these three is enough.
Is enough.
Any one of those three, yeah. We're not giving a criminal a blank check and saying... Yeah.
And these three basically are required now.
Really, they are, yeah, basically.
I mean, as far as...
Except that these mean more to if you took 10 people at random, college education, high school, grade school, whatever, off the street and talked in terms of intention, knowing and reckless and negligent, I think maybe it would make more sense than the distinction between willful and wanton, for instance.
I think I've always thought that a criminal intent is a necessary element of any crime unless the statute said otherwise.
I think I would like to agree with you, but there are too many decisions where courts have said, well, we don't think so. We don't think the legislature intended it in this particular situation.
Because of something that appears in the statute, squinting that way.
Yeah. And I'm afraid sometimes because something that was a celebrated cause is out in the newspapers, and the legislature must have meant this in spite of the fact that the court doesn't exactly express it this way.
Well, I agree that I always thought that a criminal intent was required unless the statute expressly said otherwise. I agree wholeheartedly that it's incumbent upon us to insert in the specific crimes that we
propose here the element that is intentional, knowing, or reckless. But I want to go back to unauthorized and authorized use of the motor vehicle and ask if we don't have to insert one of those terms in there.
Would you read it over a moment, and let's make a judgment on it, kind of.
A person commits a crime in unauthorized use of a vehicle when he takes, operates, exercises control over, rides in, or otherwise uses another's vehicle, boat, or aircraft without consent of the owner.
All right. My response to that is that if that's the statute, no, we don't have to go back and do anything with it, because except to be very careful that we review it, one could be guilty of committing that crime if he intentionally did it. In other words, I go down and I mean to get in your station wagon and go with it. I could be guilty of it if I went down, I don't care exactly what I do, but I'm practically certain that this isn't mine. I think it's yours. I'm not absolutely certain, but I'm practically certain. So I get in and do it. Okay, I'm guilty. Now let's say that realizing that there is a substantial risk that it isn't mine and that it's yours, and being aware of that risk, I nevertheless do it. I'm guilty under that statute. Period. Now that's so. One of those three mental elements is required for guilt.
Well, I thought you said a minute ago that it was incumbent upon us to say what we meant in the specific statute.
All right. Then I've misled you.
Going back on the negligence.
If you would allow guilt under that statute on the basis of negligence, you'd have to say so.
Or if you just wanted it intentionally, you want knowingly or recklessly, you have to specify that. Which is
right.
With these gradations, when we've got different degrees of crime, if you only want the highest element to exist, or the two highest, then you have to state those.
And I think what I'm saying is also here that you could not set up a crime where one was guilty without one of the four elements, without specifically saying so.
All right. So then, that being the case, it's unnecessary for us, unless we have some compelling reason to make this the highest degree, it's unnecessary for us to put it in the statute.
That's right.
All right. So there were some we did and some we didn't. Right there.
Well, and there are some where we used this language with respect to a certain element of the crime or a certain act. For example, theft by receiving. We have in there the element of knowledge that the property was stolen. Here, your definition of knowing would be applicable, I would think.
I think when we put those words in, our thinking was basically the philosophy of these sections.
Right. And reckless burning of property. We use reckless. Because we meant reckless. And we were talking about something less than an intentional use of the fire or an intent to burn. And I think if you go through the model penal code, you'll see that, for example, their statute on unauthorized use of vehicles does not use any of this language out of their definition section. That they define unauthorized use. A person commits a misdemeanor if he operates another's automobile, etc., without consent of the owner. Nowhere in their recommended draft on unauthorized use do they use purposely in there. They don't use recklessly. I mean, this other language.
We apply in every case unless we specifically said that the mere fact that you do such and such is a crime, regardless of whether you intended to do it or whether you knew the circumstances or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incumbent on us really to make affirmative exceptions, I guess we'd call
it. Yeah, and I think this duty is on the commission, that whatever has been drafted to date, that somewhere along the line it's going to be necessary to go back over it and say, did we really mean this or didn't we mean this?
This is why we talked at the last subcommittee meeting about getting on with this sort of stuff, because we were afraid we were going to wind up with a whole new code without having figured out what general principles we're going to apply to it. I don't agree with your suggestion that we go home and read about this.
Well, okay.
this subcommittee has not operated by going home and reading it.
Okay.
And no, it just.
We've just made the mistakes over and over.
It just makes its own mistakes and does them all. I'm not familiar. You said that in one portion of this, you have departed from, you're suggesting we depart substantially from existing Oregon law.
Oh,
a new policy decision.
Oh.
As reckless as compared with gross negligence.
Yeah.
That's it.
And I don't really think we're departing that far. It's a question
of
which you're going to use for a particular crime.
Right. Well, I just wanted to get straight down my own mind what we're talking about.
Now, an example of a statute where we, in fact, we have used this language, at least some of it, criminal mischief, for example. The person commits a crime of criminal mischief in the second degree if, having no right to do so, no reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, he intentionally damages property of another. There we're talking about an intentional act, as that term would be defined according to the draft. Or B, recklessly damages property in an amount exceeding $100. So there we used language, and at the time we used this language, we realized that by reckless we were talking about this risk and a conscious disregard, but something less than an intent to actually damage the property. But in that we felt, since it wasn't an intentional damage, that in order to make it a crime, we would tack on the element of value.
A reduced blameworthiness may attach your value judgment was when there's less at stake.
Yes.
Now, in the good old days, that would have been a malicious mischief statute, and whoever maliciously does a thing would have been the mental element tacked on, wouldn't it? What in God's name does malicious mean? Does it mean that you hated the person or hated this, or does it mean that you did an act involving an unreasonable risk that this harm would take place? So you had to go to the case law to find out what did you mean by malicious. And I think this suggestion, this setup, which is certainly not mine, is more communicative and is more